and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kobe Tatwait. The UNGA, United Nations General Assembly, has adopted a resolution against Israel on multiple issues, from settlement buildings to the continued destruction of Palestinian homes, the expulsion of Palestinian families from East outlets, and the deprivation of Palestinians of the right to reside there. And the key question is, will this actually change anything on the ground, especially Israel's behavior? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why UN resolutions have not changed Israeli illegal actions in the past, and what can actually alter its actions. First, let's find out about these resolutions against Israel on multiple fronts. Our correspondent, Mona Kandil, joins us from occupied Ramallah. Mona, welcome. So we're looking at a whole draft of different issues that the UNGA has actually voted on. Give us a summary, if you can, briefly, of course, of what those issues are.
Well, first of all, Palestinian Minister of Foreign Affairs, Dr. Riyad Al-Maliki, had welcomed the unanimous vote in favor of the resolutions that were adopted by the Fourth Committee of the UN General Assembly. As you have mentioned, there were several issues adopted by the UN General Assembly. It condemned Israel over construction of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank and in Al-Quds. It also slammed the continued destruction of Palestinian homes in Area C, in the Bedouin villages, and the expulsion of Palestinians from their homes illegally. It also slammed the ongoing and non-stop settler violence against Palestinians and their children, as well as the destruction of the agricultural lands and the confiscation of the Palestinian lands in order to annex the Israeli settlements. So Palestinians today are hoping that these resolutions that were adopted by the United Nations General Assembly to be translated into acts on ground, not only continue this condemnation from this body to Israel, knowing that without sanctions being imposed on the Israeli regime, the Israeli regime would be continuing its aggressive policies and aggression against the people of Palestine.
Thank you very much for that. That's Mona Kandil, a correspondent from occupied Ramallah. Thank you for that. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight, Professor of California State University at San Bernardino and co-producer of the award-winning documentary 1948, Creation and Catastrophe. Ahlam Muhtasab joins us from Murrieta, California. We also have British politician and former MP Chris Williamson joining us from Derby in the UK.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both, and if I may first start with you, Ahlam Muhtasab. You know, you have this thing that has happened at the UNGA, and you have the majority of countries actually saying, okay, this is, you know, this is something that we realize, and we're going to vote for this. But it's not the first time that this has happened, and of course, as a correspondent there said, you know, it creates this hope for the Palestinians. But not very optimistic for this to translate to action on the ground is the general consensus. How do you see it?
Good evening. I actually, probably for the first time in a long time, am more pessimistic and doesn't have as much hope as I used to for several reasons. The first one is the United Nations vote itself. It was great, you know, acknowledgement of the suffering and oppression of Palestinian people by the majority of world countries. Unfortunately, the usual suspect, including the country I live in and have its citizenship, which is the United States, in addition to Canada and Israel, of course, they voted against and tried, actually, as usual, to stop this vote from happening. And my view is that as long as the United States is blindly supporting Israel with almost no change really in policy after we have the Biden administration and some people having this false hope that it would change things on the ground, unfortunately it's not. Israel, it seems for us Palestinians that as if Israel has nothing to do in terms of running a state except oppressing Palestinians with new forms every day on the ground, from killing, you know, children like what happened last week to what is happening in Jerusalem at several fronts. Like it's so unbelievable. Like we are stretched thin, you know, whether we are talking about Atur neighborhood or Mount Olive, Jabal al-Zaytun, where actually 10 families are being threatened of demolishing their apartment building, hosting it, or, you know, like with 70 members of different families, 10 different families occupying it, 5 stories, of being demolished or forcing those, you know, owners to demolish their own homes. To the Yassinia grave cemetery, you know, where they are actually digging out graves. They're not leaving the dead, even the Palestinian dead, to Al-Aqsa, to Sheikh Jarrah, to Silwan. It's a constant battle, really. And the biggest hit was, of course, when 2 weeks ago, about 2 weeks ago, a little bit over 2 weeks ago, when they labeled 6 important Palestinian civil organizations as terrorist organizations with no evidence whatsoever. And actually yesterday, the United Nations, several United Nations agencies condemned Israel for labeling those organizations as terrorists and identify this actually as a crackdown on democracy, on civil society, and stated that they would continue working with those organizations. But of course, on the ground, when Israel is controlling life of Palestinians, this step in criminalizing very important, crucial organizations like Damir, Al-Haq, Al-Bustan, etc., this has actually huge impact on Palestinians, especially the role of these organizations in documenting Israeli violations of human rights. Mm-hmm. And actually, this leads me to very important to mention the impact, the terrible impact on Palestinian prisoners, especially those on hunger strike, which I would like, if you don't mind, mention them very quickly.
Sure.
And how long they have been on hunger strike. And at Damir, one of the organizations that had been criminalized, it played a very crucial role in documenting their plight and the plight of Palestinian prisoners all over the world. We have Kayad al-Fasfus on today. He starts 119 days on hunger strike. He hit another record number. The last record number for hunger strikers among Palestinians was 103 days by Maher al-Akhras. And not only Kayad al-Fasfus, but also Miqdad al-Qawasmi, who starts 112 days today. Sure. Hisham Abu Hawash, 85 days. Alaa al-A'raj, 94 days. Iyad al-Hirami, 53 days. Lu'ay al-Ashqar, 31 days. And there are actually other Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike who just started recently to actually join the original 600 hunger strikers. Excuse me. But the last point I want to say that their lives are in danger, especially Kayad al-Fasfus and Miqdad al-Qawasmi. Miqdad al-Qawasmi's sentence was frozen for a month in a trick by the Israeli authorities to actually force them to either end their hunger strike or to, avoid the responsibility of their death and push it on to their families. But the Palestinian prisoners continued their hunger strike.
Sure.
And last week, they reinstated their administrative detention, which means detaining those prisoners indefinitely without charges.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Well, Chris Williamson, we could dedicate not just this half hour but rather days and weeks as to what happens in terms of violations of the occupied territories. Time obviously does not allow us to do that. But my question to you is, when you have the UNGA come up and make these resolutions and cite specifically what has happened, I'm thinking that logic would dictate, if you want results, follow it through with an action plan. Do these types of resolutions get followed through with an action plan in order to change Israel's behavior?
Well, regrettably not, but I am hopeful that things are changing now. I think there's a much greater awareness amongst the wider general public, both in the United States and indeed certainly in the United Kingdom, about the abuses of Israel. I think, to be honest with you, the Zionist lobby has overplayed its hand in their efforts to try and chill free speech about their atrocities in Israel. And I think as a consequence of that, it's brought their activities to the attention of a much wider audience. And so people now, I think, are increasingly horrified about what is happening. And of course, with the advent of new technology and smartphones, what we're seeing in Gaza, for example, is young people who are tech savvy, who speak good English, who are acting as citizen journalists, really. And so they're able to capture on their phones and broadcast over the internet the actuality of the Israeli brutality. I mean, Israel is a terrorist state, and, you know, frankly, countries like the United Kingdom, the United States should, in my opinion, have absolutely nothing to do with them. We should be looking to actually isolate Israel and break off diplomatic relations with them until such time as they comply with international law. But of course, the military-industrial complex is very powerful, both in the UK and, of course, in the United States even more so. And it is incredibly profitable selling armaments to the Israeli state. And we also know, through work of groups like the Declassified UK, a new media outlet which is dedicated to exposing the activities of the deep state in the UK and the security services, and what they've discovered is that the UK has collaborated with the Israeli state, both in terms of sharing intelligence information, but also in terms of the issue in relation to the testing and the selling, certainly, of arms. Indeed, Britain is a big exporter, in fact, the world's second biggest arms exporter, and many of those arms do go to Israel. But I think the, you know, the establishment, the government is certainly no friend to the Palestinian people, and is very much, I think, increasingly out of step with public opinion on this issue, despite the best efforts of the Zionist lobby here, who have weaponized anti-Semitism in an attempt to try and, you know, stop those voices speaking out about what's happening there. But it isn't working. And as I say, people are increasingly angered about what is happening. And we only saw, I think it was yesterday, the Israeli ambassador subject to a very noisy demonstration at the LSE in London. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that as a result of grassroots activity, people's revulsion about what is happening, that pressure will be applied, and we will see, you know, campaigns like the BDS campaign, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions campaign, gaining strength. And I think, you know, we have to draw some comfort from that, mm-hmm. and encourage that sort of activity in order to bring pressure on the policymakers to make the right decision.
Sure. Well, I mean, that all sounds good in terms of what you just said. But I'd like to ask you, Ahlam Motassa, we're talking about Israel, in which just recently Israel's UN envoy tore up the Human Rights Council report on the General Assembly to investigate May's Gaza conflict on the podium there. BDS is great, media attention is great, UN resolutions are great, but I think you touched on one thing that perhaps is the key here, and my question to you is the staunch support that the U.S. has for Israel. Do you think that if that was not to be in the form that it is, that perhaps then the door would be open for there to be alterations in the way Israel deals with Palestinians? because we're looking at the unwavering support that the U.S. has had for Israel?
Thank you for the question. Unfortunately, I would say yes. I mean, the U.S. plays a very crucial role, actually, in maintaining the colonization and oppression of Palestinian people. And I agree with your guest speaker that, yes, we do have a lot of resistance, and we will never end the resistance. I mean, we will resist in all forms available to us as Palestinians and supporters of Palestinians. And it is true, if you look at the latest opinion polls in the United States, more and more people actually know what is happening. And more people have more empathy to the Palestinian plight. More and more people understand the context, you know, of the conflict factually more accurate manner than what is presented to them on mainstream U.S. media. And even among actually Jewish Americans who had been the backbone of the Israeli lobby in the U.S., which was, of course, plays a very crucial role in maintaining U.S. policy. So we have actually a great, I would say great shift, although it might sound not as much, among especially young Jewish Americans and among young Americans in general. And even with mainstream media, they are forced because of social media to somehow change, you know, their presentation of information a bit. You know, they now diversify their sources a little bit more. They include some Palestinian voices, especially, you know, the latest round with the Sheikh Jarrah and Saif al-Quds in Gaza. But unfortunately, what makes me feel still not as optimistic as I should be probably is the fact that in terms of policy, we see very little change. You know, the Congress passed only now about less than a month ago a new resolution to give Israel blindly $1 billion in military aid that goes to support the dome, you know, over Israel and to fortify their defenses, etc. And so for me, like, I would love to believe that the actions we are taking as resistance, you know, in terms of BDS or other forms of resistance, Palestinians on the ground, are actually making difference. But the difference in terms of, like, it doesn't materialize really in U.S. policy, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We have new voices in Congress that speak up against Israel and votes differently, which is you know, a welcome change, of course. But unfortunately, we just gave them $1 billion that we could have used in the United States. My students, I have so many students at the university, graduate students, who are food insecure, who are hungry, who are homeless. Can we just use this money, actually, to support American citizens instead? American programs. Sure. And this is in addition to the $3 billion annually. So that's how I look at things, and I wish I could bring more optimism to this conversation now. It has been a tough day for me.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm curious over here. I mean, we could talk about all the different violations. It's been talked about. They continue practically on a daily basis. But Chris Williamson, our guest there, talks about this recent $1 billion that the U.S. is going to provide for Israel. I'm not too sure if it's on top of that $3.7 billion that U.S. gives Israel in terms of military aid. But what if the money was focused on reaching what needs to be done, which has failed for the past decades, and that is peace between Israel and Palestine? And why it is that this administration is not really approaching it. It's rarely touched upon. From what it appears, of course, the U.S. President Joe Biden has his hands full. I'm denying that, but at the same time, this is a pretty important issue that needs to obviously be dealt with. Why do you think it's not at this point by the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I think politics is broken on both sides of the Atlantic, both in the United Kingdom and the United States, and the mainstream political parties do not represent the interests of the ordinary people on both sides of the pond, as it were. And as far as the Biden administration is concerned, it seems to me they're in the pockets of the military-industrial complex, and certainly in the pocket, I think, of the Israel lobby. But there's lots of money to be made from selling arms, as I've already said, and I think that is the problem. And so I don't think we can put our faith in the existing politicians What we need to do is build the grassroots movement. And as I understand it, in the United States, there is now a third party, and a third party being established, and support for that is growing quite substantially. And I think, you know, when that starts to make some inroads, which I think it has some potential for, because as again I understand from polling which has been taking place in the United States, there is substantial support, well over 50% support for a third party to emerge there. Whether people then go on and vote for it, of course, is another question. But turnouts in elections in the United States are not very high. I mean, I think the order of 50 or so percent. So there's a lot of people who, you know, do not participate in elections. And I think if a third party can break through, and there are similar moves happening in the United Kingdom as well, and if a third party can start to break through, there is a chance that, well, one, they may make substantial progress and, you know, maybe replace the Democrats, but I think perhaps what is more likely to happen is that they will put additional pressure, and that will, I think, concentrate the minds. Because at the moment, all the pressure is coming from the Israel lobby, and they are an incredibly powerful lobby, let's be clear about that. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think both the Democrats and the Republicans dance to their tune. And so that's why it's important to put a lot of effort into building the, you know, the grassroots resistance, because that can then bring pressure to bear on these politicians. And if they are fearful about potentially losing their seats, losing their careers, that will certainly concentrate their minds. So I think we need a counterweight to the power of the Israel lobby in the UK and the United States. So once that starts to kind of even up the playing field a little bit, then I think we will start to see some big policy changes taking place.
Read it somewhere. Not too sure, just entered my mind now, and I'm going to ask you, Ahla Muqtasib, that an article mentioned that Israel does not want this conflict to end. Israel actually gains from this conflict, from the military aid that the U.S. provides, and for it to continue doing what it's doing in the occupied territories. We can mention the map as Palestinian land just keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. I'm sure you've seen that. Is that the case? Is it because that Israel gains more with this conflict ongoing instead for it to actually reach a conclusion?
Yes. First, I have I would like to thank Mr. Williamson for bringing in the military-industrial complex into this conversation, because it's a very crucial issue. And actually, it relates to what you just said, which is, does either actually of the United States or Israel do, does either one of them want this conflict to be resolved? And the answer is no. Because of that, because of the huge amount of money they make off of this conflict. In terms, or in the case of Israel, there is a very good book that Jeff Halber, who is actually an American-Israeli author, wrote a few years ago, I think in 2015, if I'm not mistaken, and I can't remember its name. But in that book, he argued the case that Israel uses the West Bank and Gaza, especially Gaza, of course, mm-hmm. as a lab for testing their military technologies. And their military technologies don't only have to be missiles and shells, and sure. it has a wide range, actually, of technologies, including spyware, for example. Just last week, the Biden administration, in a very unprecedented...
Okay. I am so sorry, and I apologize. We're just fresh out of time. I have to jump in. I do apologize for that. Thank you very much for your contribution, Ahla Muqtasib, professor of California State University in San Bernardino and co-producer of the award-winning documentary 1948 Creation and Catastrophe. Also, Chris Williamson, thank you for your input, British politician and former MP. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavit Afli, it's goodbye until next time.
Sheikh Baghir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile everything that is recorded as the seerah of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam in the books.
Late Qarashi, he mentions, among my works, I had a kind of mind-changing work being included in the lifestyle of Imam Sajjad.
He changed the world for the better and made us a better creatures. Oh Allah.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
We wronged ourselves. What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRabi English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. The Teacher is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and scholars all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Ziyaniya and Sheikh Mahdavi. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam, dear brother.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, in our last episode, we were concerned with the life and works of Bagha Sharif al-Gharashi from Iraq, one of the most outstanding Shiite historian and biographers. And today we want to talk about his most outstanding work, that is Mawsu'atu Siratul Ahl Bayt alayhum as-salam, which is considered one of the most comprehensive works written in the Arabic language regarding the lifestyle and the conduct of Ahlul Bayt. First of all, let's talk a little bit about title, Mawsu'ah. What is Mawsu'ah? Because, you know, there are also so many other works which enjoy this title, I mean this term, Mawsu'ah. What does it mean?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Mawsu'ah is a technical term in, Islamic studies and in academic studies that we may say that is referring to collecting every related issue to a proper subject. For example, when we are talking about Mawsu'atul Hayat al-Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam or Mawsu'atul Hayat al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wa salam, it means that we decide to collect everything that is related with the personality, with the life, with the figure of the Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wa salam, and that is including, for example, his words, his life, his date of birth, his martyrdom, and his children, his family, and the situation in which he was living, and the activities that he had done during his lifetime, and many different things that are related to the personality of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam or other infallibles.
So, in general, we could say that Mawsu'ah is a detailed account. Is it so?
Yes.
Can be translated as a detailed account of the life account or the lifestyle of an infallible imam or from among the 14 Masumin. That's right. Bagha Sharif al-Gharashi compiled many works, Sheikh Mahdavi, and as you said, upon the suggestion of Shahid al-Sadr, he dedicated himself to Islamic history and the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt. But what is this seerah? I mean, talk a little bit about the seerahs, the seerah of Ahlul Bayt and the seerah of ulama, I mean this lifestyle and account. What fruits and what importance does it have in order to be studied?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The word seerah, when we talk about the word seerah in Arabic, we mean the certain type of manners and behaviors a person would do during the time. When we say, for example, what type of seerah your teacher had when he would teach you, we mean that what type of behavior, what type of personality, the methodology that he would do during his teaching in our class. This is his lifestyle, or better, if we go through his lifestyle, we're talking about his lifestyle. But during his teaching, the type of manners and behaviors he would do to teach and deliver the lessons, this is the seerah. The word seerah refers to. So when we talk about the seerah of Ahlul Bayt, generally speaking, we are trying to include a comprehensive field of study.
That's
the
right.
Way Ahlul Bayt would treat people, I mean general people, their students, khulafa, in their environment, the way they would practice different concepts.
That's right.
For example, his seerah regarding his generosity.
That's
if
right.
A faqir or if a needy people would refer to them, what type of behavior Imam Hassan had, or what type of behavior and treatment Ahlul Bayt had in terms of treating with needy people and poor people.
So out of these books, or out of this series of the books of Sharif al-Gharashi, we could take out practical lessons.
Definitely.
In order to apply in our lives, and that's really beautiful.
And, sometimes they say that, for example, the seerah of the lifestyle of an imam might date back to, I don't know, more than 1,000 years ago. What is the application today? What's your answer to that? I mean, out of the book of the seerah of Ahlul Bayt, can we use really in the modern world them and take them practical lessons for today's world?
I think this is a very nice question, and this is not only applied in this field of study. We can apply it generally to the whole regulation, because when we talk about Islam, we see that Islam has been initiated 1,400 years ago. Yes. So the type of the regulation and laws that have been issued back then might have no use in our time. Why? Because the world has changed, the time has changed. So what is the response for this question? Mm-hmm. We have to say, okay, in terms of some issues that have nothing to do with the spirituality or the nature of human being, time has nothing to do with that.
Okay,
human being is a human being, no matter if he was living 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, or he is living right now.
That's right.
He is human being in terms of marrying. He is human being in terms of worshiping the Lord. He is human being in terms of having the eternal life. But in terms of, for example, type of eating,
yes,
types of transportation, types of things like this, it has nothing to do with the nature of human being.
That's right.
So it may change during the time and throughout the history.
That's right.
And human being might adopt the changes.
That's right.
Of the life and the world and the time.
That's right.
So what you are right now talking about, why are we reading the seerah of Ahlul Bayt? The seerah of Ahlul Bayt, in terms of the nature of human being treating with different people.
That's right.
No matter which level of the society they are coming from. So in that time, the same thing that they were doing could be applied.
That's right.
When we are talking about our time.
That's right.
So, for example, if a needy people would refer to them the kind of respect that they would present,
yes,
at that moment.
Yes.
We have to apply it in our time, mm-hmm, and in our life. It has nothing to do saying that, okay, since 1400 years mm-hmm passed, now we have to generate a different type of behavior. No.
That's right.
We should treat people based on their dignity, based on their knowledge,
that's
based
right
on their humanity, not based on their wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So these type of issues have nothing to do with the change of time.
That's right. So if you want to be more familiar with the true practitioners of the Islam, we have to refer to the books which is written on seerah.
I may add a point to the points that my brother Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned.
Very good.
That studying seerah is very beneficial for us to get as much close to the teachings of Islam to have the best Islamic society.
Yes.
If we need to have Islamic society, we need to get as much as possible to the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam and the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Inshallah. Okay, thank you Sheikh Ziyania for your explanation regarding the seerah. Now let's get back to the Mawsu'ah itself. So when Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi wrote Mawsu'ah of Ahlul Bayt, was he only concerned with the Ahlul Bayt or no? For example, because when we say Ahlul Bayt, a specific people comes to the mind, you know? Or no, the other people during the history of Islam were also concerned in that book? And what about Prophet Muhammad? What about Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra? Were these also included among the writings of Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi or not?
Yes, you know, because he wanted, as this suggestion of Shahid al-Sadr,
yes,
that he told him that we need to revise the history of Islam and Siratul Ma'sumin. So Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile everything that is recorded as the seerah of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam in the books. So he starts with the life of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and he compiles this book in 3 volumes, but he have more 37 volumes regarding the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam. I mean the 13 infallibles including Sayyidah Fatima salamullah alayha, And then he continues, you know, some volumes to talk about, for example, the life of Sayyida Zainab Salamullah alayha, even the life of Abbas ibn Ali, I mean Qamar bani Hashim, and Hayatu Shahid Muslim ibn Aqil. These people and these figures who are not infallible, but they are, you know, like the
minor parts of the Ahlul Bayt, you mean? That's right. The people who are somehow related to the family of Prophet Muhammad and the infallible Imams and are specific figures for a Shiite history is also included in the Mawsu'ah.
Yes, so they are great figures, but they are not Imams.
They are not infallible.
In that level.
Yes.
And maybe we would ask why Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi is giving the details of the life of these figures. We should notice that, yes, these figures are not infallible. They are not, you know, in the degree of Imams or in the level of Imams. But these figures are really great. And, you know, their behavior, it does not mean that when we say that they are not Imam, it means that they were, na'udhu billah, they were committing sins. No.
No.
They were in a very high level of piety.
Yes. Yes.
So we need to study their, you know, life to find out how we as, you know, normal people also can follow Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. Beside that, these figures, for example, Sayyida Zainab salamullah alayha, has sacrificed her life for the sake of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam. So she is included in the life of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, as Muslim ibn Aqil, as Ghabar ibn Hashim. So these figures are related to the life of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam.
That's right.
And Mawsu'ah in its broad meaning is covering this, you know, concept also.
Because when we separately look at the books, we find the word Hayat, for example, Hayat al-Imam al-Hassan al-Mujtaba, Hayat al-Muslim Naghir Hayat, the life or the lifestyle of these outstanding men and women during the history. And as you said, that's right, there are also so many lessons which can be learned from the people who were not directly from among the Ahlul Bayt, but related to the families of Ahlul Bayt. For example, the loyalty of Qamar ibn Hashim, the faithfulness of Muslim ibn Aqil, you know, and all these traits that can be still practiced in the life of the Muslims today are really important and can be taken out. Unfortunately, I mean, these works, I mean, the series of the works on the lives of the infallible Imams of Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi have been translated into English language too. And this is the good news for us. Okay, Sheikh Mahdavi, do you have any other detail about the book and the research method, or maybe the method of bringing up the content of this book?
Okay, I think it's good to know about this big compilation of lifestyle of Ahlul Bayt, because sometimes for our audience, if they are familiar with the history of Ahlul Bayt, they might be of this opinion that what new things are going to be included in these 40 volumes. Most of the knowledge or most of the main ideas are the repetitive things that we are familiar with.
That's right.
So they may not think that they have to take a look into these books. But for example, late Qarashi, he mentions, among my works, I had a kind of mind-changing works being included in the lifestyle of Imam Sajjad. The thing or the main idea we are familiar with the lifestyle of Imam Sajjad is the Imam who kept dedicating his life to worshiping. So if we go to a Muslim or a Shia young person and ask him about the lifestyle of Imam Sajjad, the main thing he might refer to is the, for example, he was Zainul Abidin. He was the best of the worshiper. But he's trying to establish this idea that Imam Sajjad must be considered as the founder of new civilization, Islamic civilization.
Okay.
He mentions or take into account 200 scholars being cultivated under the hands of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. So this is a very important thing that he is trying to deliver this message, that do not consider that what you are familiar with are going to be included in my book. No, there are new things.
Or Imam Sajjad, for example, as a secluded person, was always been worshipping and worshipping and worshipping and not doing anything else.
Yeah, he is saying that he was the reviver of the Islamic culture in that corrupted environment, specifically after the Yazid.
Yes.
And when he comes to the lifestyle or the life of Imam Sadiq, which is included in 7 volumes, he considers this work out of the best works in this compilation, saying that I dedicated part of my life to author this book. And one of the things that I was trying to consider in this book was to compile the name of the students,
yes,
and the name of the scholars being cultivated under the hand of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He mentions 3,652 scholars, not the student. He,
yes,
says the number of the students is above 400, 500. This is something that, which is also recorded in Sunni histories.
Yes.
But he mentions above 3,000 scholars.
You mean 40, 50,000, the whole people, and yes,
yes,
more than
and
scholars.
This,
that's
yes,
right.
This 3,000, okay, they are scholars. They
that's
were
all right.
not just ordinary students.
Okay.
So he says that I was trying to compile their names in order to establish or in order to demonstrate the position of Imam Sadiq in that environment and in
that's
that
right.
Time, specific
okay.
time.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziaynia. I think the people from the other fields of studies, like, for example, those who are working on the cinematic formats, those who are interested in producing movies or documentaries on the life of the imams, also can benefit very much from the books of
sure.
Baghir Sharif Al-Gharashi, as they used to do that, you know, because in the filmmaking, upon the seerah and the details and the events of the life of an infallible Imam or Prophet Muhammad, they need authentic sources. And I think Baghir Sharif Al-Gharashi is for sure one of the people or one of the scholars whose works are very much trusted, trustworthy, and authentic. And the filmmakers, the those who are artists, they can all refer to these works in order to be more familiar with the true seerah and lifestyle and life account of the infallible Imams. Okay, it was very kind of you, Sheikh Ziaynia and Sheikh Mahtavi. Thank you very much for your presence in the program, the teacher. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this episode and to download for free our other episodes on this program, you can visit our website at parstoday.com/en. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As Afghans witness their most difficult days, the 12th round of Iranian aid to Afghanistan arrived in Kabul. Dispatches, including 5 tons of medicines and 5 tons of food, are meant to treat injuries and be distributed to the families of victims of Daesh terrorist group attack on Sardar Mohammad Daud Khan Hospital in Kabul.
Iran's been sending a series of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan since the beginning of the recent crisis in the country, at the recommendation of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to help our brothers. This current shipment will target those who were injured and lost their beloved ones in the recent Daesh terrorist group attack on Sardar Mohammad Daud Khan Hospital in Kabul.
Taliban officials welcome emergency aid to the country and thank those who stay by the Afghan side in the darkest days. People suffering from poverty and difficulties await more help from the world countries.
We thank Iran for its humanitarian aid to our people. May God give them in return. Iranian aids have always been on time, especially when they helped us with emergency aid after 2 large mosque blasts. Today, our people in a critical situation and need help. So the world countries should help us and free our frozen assets.
The recent crisis largely affected our poor people. We don't have anything to eat or treat our patients. My brother is injured. Now he is under treatment here. Neither the hospital has enough medicines, nor do we have enough money to buy them from outside.
At least 25 people were killed and more than 50 wounded when Daesh terrorist gunmen attacked the 400-bed Sardar Mohammad Daud Khan Hospital after 2 heavy explosions at the site in central Kabul. Daesh attacks come as hunger crises are looming in the country.
Some countries, including Iran, have been sending shipments of aid. However, to address the problem of hunger in Afghanistan, more international assistance is needed. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Furious students gathered outside the London School of Economics on Tuesday to condemn the university after its debate society invited Israel's UK ambassador to speak at an evening event. The university claimed the event is meant to encourage discourse about the Middle East, but a large number of Muslim and pro-Palestine students are having none of it.
These students are not just angry at the fact that the Israeli ambassador is speaking here today, but they're also venting their frustrations at the university and the debate society as well. They say that by inviting the ambassador to speak here today, they've essentially platformed racism and Islamophobia.
Appointed in 2020, Israel's Zippy Hotovely has been condemned over past comments she made targeting Arabs and Islam. She once reportedly denied Palestine's existence and famously said the Nakba was a great Arab lie.
This is against what the student body wanted. For this university, all the students here are deeply ashamed. This university has failed to recognize and represent the student body.
Someone like this person doesn't really deserve the right to speak about them. She has made comments dehumanizing an entire people. If she can dehumanize people and invalidate their right to speak, why should she have any sort of rights?
So she's actually a preacher, a hate preacher, legitimizing killing children, legitimizing destroying Palestinian hope, legitimizing the expansion of settlers, brutally destroying the crops and everything of the Palestinian.
We as a Jews, we feel obliged to stand up against this racist, against this fascist, and what she presents and who she presents. And we want to encourage the students to come out again in the open for justice, for peace.
Despite the backlash and a walkout staged by students inside the debate hall, the talk went ahead. The Palestinian ambassador will also speak, but at a separate event on the 11th of November. But that hasn't been enough to calm the students' anger. Robert Carter, London.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
the people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment and custodial torture continue with impunity, while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over 7 decades. Both countries claim the region in full, but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Senior military commanders parade and salute army soldiers as the last phase of a 3-day maneuver, codenamed Zulfaqar 1400. The military exercise engaged the 4 branches of the Iranian army and was held over a 1 million square kilometer area, stretching from the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. Army commanders say the drill was a success and it carries regional and global messages.
The Islamic Republic has in recent years proved that it can be the axis of regional security, which entails a collective regional cooperation. If regional states join hands, they can protect the security of the region without the need to rely on foreigners. History has shown that foreign countries would never bring sustainable security to any nation.
The massive drill kicked off on Sunday with surface and subsurface vessels, air and naval flights, radars and missile systems. The Army also deployed its latest combat and reconnaissance drones, which are produced domestically. The Islamic Republic takes great pride in indigenizing its defense arsenal against the backdrop of an all-out sanctions regime by the U.S. that blocks Iran's access to even a bullet from other countries.
The Iranian army is prepared to confront any force that could possibly threaten Iran's territorial integrity and interests. Using our indigenous defense equipment, we are capable of defending our soil and will nip in the bud any threat from our enemies.
Situated in a geopolitically sensitive region, Iran holds regular drills as a means to enhance its preparedness in the face of possible threats, such as terrorism and piracy. Iran's armed forces have on different occasions underscored that the country will not be the first to pull the trigger, and its military doctrine is based on deterrence, not aggression.
The 3-day military exercise wrapped up with important messages. On top of them is that Iran is strongly opposed to any foreign presence in the regional waters, describing it as destabilizing and provocative. The Iranian army says Iran and other regional countries are the ones that are responsible for ensuring the security of the region. And this means extraterritorial forces must go home. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
The ongoing Saudi-imposed war has put a further strain on the already fragmented education system of Yemen. In a recent report, UNICEF said more than 2 million Yemeni children remain out of school, as nearly 3/4 of public school teachers in several governorates have not been paid for over 2 school years.
Since the first moment of the Saudi-led war, the educational process has been directly targeted, whether by air raids that targeted the schools and their surroundings, or by depriving teachers of their due salaries. Also, a large number of schools were converted into shelters for the displaced, and some schools were closed because they are located on the front lines of the military battles. All these factors have caused a low level of education for Yemeni children.
The report added that an estimated 1.7 million children are internally displaced and more than 8 million children do not have access to safe water, sanitation or hygiene, which contributes to a growing number of children suffering from acute malnutrition and infectious diseases such as cholera.
It is clear that targeting the educational process is a priority for the Saudi-led coalition, and for this reason, over 7 years, we have suffered a lot. And what helped us is the sense of responsibility on the part of teachers and parents. UN statistics say 2 million children do not have access to education, and 8 million children do not get their most basic needs, and this is a real catastrophe.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in March 2015, the kingdom has bombed over 1,100 schools and 180 universities in a clear violation of the international humanitarian law that protects educational facilities as civilian objects.
As the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate in Yemen due to the ongoing Saudi war and the blockade, children continue to be the ones who pay the heaviest price. UNICEF describes Yemen as the most dangerous place on earth for children to grow up. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنعاء.
Europe is divided over how to deal with the mounting humanitarian crisis on its borders. Some are calling for walls and barbed wire. Asylum seekers are being used as pawns in political disputes, and desperate people mercilessly pushed back and forth between borders, left to die in the space between with no food or shelter. The UN has called foul, but it seems no one is listening.
Yet the European Union's 28 members seem to be absolutely abysmally hopeless in organizing any kind of real strategy around migrants and their facilitation. And given, of course, that NATO and Europe is at the heart of causing a lot of the kind of migrancy that is a result of conflicts, you'd have thought that they would have had a little bit more in terms of their human rights and their sort of own, moral conscience, to do a lot better.
States around Europe's periphery are the first destinations for asylum seekers coming via sea. Greece, Italy and Turkey have been accused of violent pushbacks, and the UK is entertaining the idea of giving border forces immunity from prosecution if migrants die at sea.
All part of this neoliberal, neoconservative, imperialistic worldview, which much of the establishment in Europe has adopted for many, many years now, and it is fundamentally a barbaric, uncivilized, set of policies which show no signs of abating, and backed by that fear that they created within their public on the grassroots level, there's no real pressure on them from the public to refrain from continuing with their witch hunts and their targeting and their scapegoating of immigrants.
However, the UK's border forces refusing to implement the Home Secretary's plan for fear it will lead to more deaths at sea. Priti Patel is trying to introduce a clause to the Nationality and Borders Bill that will see those arriving via irregular routes receive a prison sentence of up to 4 years. But human rights organizers say Europe's compassion for survivors of war is abysmally low, considering the part they play in conflicts around the world.
Countries like France, Italy, and the UK have blood on their hands, continuing to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the likes of Israel, the last apartheid on earth, and Saudi Arabia, which has been ravaging Yemen for the last 7 years, pushing it to the brink of famine. Bianca Rahimi, London.